Hello, everybody. This is John Rosania, and I'm here on the Myers Way podcast with Dr. Amy Myers. Today, we are talking about gluten, everything you wanted to know about gluten. Dr. Myers, are you there?
I'm here.
So this is the big topic. I mean, this is the buzzword that's out there right now, and it's gluten-free diets. There's a craze around that right now. Everyone's talking about gluten. And I wanted to start off by asking you, why do you think there's so much talk about gluten?
Well, I mean, we're realizing how many problems that it is causing for people outside of the intestinal tract. And so, you know, then that begs the larger question of why are we having so much what I call gluten intolerance? And, you know, I think that's for several reasons. I mean, first and foremost, we're just eating much more gluten and much more wheat and many more processed foods than we ever have in our history, right? I mean, gluten is in everything. And I know we'll get into that with all the hidden ingredients of things, but it really is found everywhere. And most people are eating it, you know, at breakfast with their breakfast cereal, then, you know, sandwich at lunch and you know, maybe a salad and soup and a big roll of bread at dinner. So where our body is being exposed to it much more frequently than ever. And the wheat that we're eating now is very different than the wheat that really our parents ate. I mean, it was about 50 years ago when this changed. So, and then, you know, as we've discussed previously, and we'll discuss in the next podcast all about the leaky gut and how, partly gluten leads to a leaky gut, but certainly other things can contribute to a leaky gut. So you can have a leaky gut from some other reason, and then thereby having gluten slip through and then having a reaction to the gluten once it slips through. So really more exposure. We've changed the wheat that we're eating now. It's been hybridized, which I'll get into, and we have leakier guts. And so those are the three reasons I believe that it's such a problem now.
Well, I think you'll kind of show here that this isn't a fad right now, that there's actually some real science behind this. I know you have some great resources on that. For all our listeners, I'm going to give you a little brief summary of what we're going to go through, just so you have a sense of that. We're going to start off with talking about some of the basics of gluten, so you can kind of get a real good understanding of gluten, and then go into the symptoms. What are the major symptoms of gluten intolerance? And talk about what Amy calls the spectrum of intensity of gluten. Then after that, we'll head into testing. So you'll figure out and learn all about what you need to do to test and what are the ways that you can test for what your level of sensitivity is. And then we'll just go into treatment and all the other kind of deeper things that Amy is working a lot on right now, which is all the hidden places of gluten. Because right now, Amy, we definitely have a lot of people talking about just gluten in general, wheat, and that found in bread. So most people know about bread and pasta, but you've got a lot of other great insights on where we find gluten that also might be affecting us. So
yes.
So great. So let's just start off. I mean, this is the basics of the basics. What is gluten? And you talked a little bit about why it's such an issue. So, you know, give us that rundown. What is gluten?
So gluten is a protein that is found in many grains, most notably wheat, and of course in rye and barley and spelt. It's not inherently found in oats, or the other grains like rice. Of course, quinoa is really a seed, but for all intents and purposes, a lot of people have sort of, it's processed like a grain is. And so these inherently don't contain gluten, but through the process of harvesting them and transport, and then on conveyor belts of processing foods, often they're cross-contaminated with gluten. So we'll get into that a little bit further, as well as cross-reactivity. So it is a protein. It's made up of two peptides, several peptides, but the main ones being gliadin and glutenin. And those two proteins have been shown to, particularly now that we've hybridized our wheat, cause problems for people. So we have, you know, those two peptides, and what we've done with our wheat is we've actually hybridized it rather than genetically modified it. We've hybridized it. So what does that mean? We've taken genes from two different plants and put them together. And when we did that, there is evidence now that there are about 5% of the proteins found in our what we call new wheat were not there before. So our body really doesn't know what to do with those proteins. And then we've also, in order to get this gluten, which gluten is like glue, it's sticky. It's what makes bread and muffins rise and be sticky. But what it also does is it keeps other foods together. And so when they realized that, they wanted to try and to find a way to extract that so that it could be added into things like, you know, protein burgers or veggie burgers or medicines and things to get stuff to stick together. So in order to do that, they actually had to deaminate the gliadins in order to get it soluble into water so then it could then be mixed into all the other stuff that we don't even think that gluten should be in. And studies have shown that when we did this, our immune system now responds to these new proteins and the way that we process this in a very immunologic way, meaning it stimulates our immune system. And that is not what was happening before. And I'll just cite one quick study here, and then we can get on to what people probably really want to hear about. But there was a really large study done in 2009 using the frozen blood of Air Force members, over 9,000 of them from the period of 1948 to 1954. They had saved their blood, and they went back and checked for celiac disease in the blood. And then they took another sample of current day, 2009, 12,000 men and women from the Air Force that sort of represented the same 9,000 back in the 40s and 50s. And they checked their blood. And they noticed that in the last 50 years, the prevalence of celiac disease used to be 1 in 700, and now it's 1 in 100. And that's celiac, and we'll get into the difference between celiac and gluten sensitivity. So that's phenomenal. I mean, that's pretty good evidence that our body really does not know what to do with these new proteins and the way that we are deconstructing wheat nowadays.
And so because our body doesn't know what to do with these proteins, lots of different symptoms come up. And I guess it's why we hear today so many different conditions being linked in some way to gluten, gluten sensitivity, celiac, all these kinds of issues that we'll be getting into. So, Amy, in your book, The Myers-Way Guide to Gluten-Free Living, I mean, already in the title, you're saying gluten-free living. So there is really something important about gluten and removing gluten and figuring out how we can live without it. And one of the things you do in the very beginning, which is very interesting, is you talk about the spectrum of intensity of gluten. So can you kind of just lay that out for us?
Sure. So I say that, you know, we have a little arrow of giving this spectrum. And usually when you're in my office, I'm sort of pointing my hands, which is at one end of the spectrum is no problem whatsoever. And then my hand goes way over to the other side of the room and says, and the other end of the spectrum is celiac. And this huge spectrum in the middle is gluten sensitivity. And you could be one step away from no problem, like it's really not causing you any issues, or you could literally be one step away from celiac. I mean, I have had a patient's son came in and he was tested for celiac, and they showed that his villi, which we'll talk about with celiac, actually were blunted, but he didn't actually test positive for celiac. So they didn't even advise him to stay off of gluten, which was absurd. I mean, he's already showing damage from gluten in his gut, but he didn't have the actual markers that the traditional gastroenterologist wanted to, you know, label him as full-blown celiac. So he didn't even tell him to stay off gluten. So this spectrum is a very broad spectrum. And, you know, because of that, people can have a whole host of different symptoms, ranging from, for one person, it could just be a little gas or bloating. For somebody else, it could be, you know, a migraine headache. For somebody else, it could be, you know, infertility. I mean, there's a whole host of things that, of how it could manifest.
So do you think that's one of the reasons why, when the popular conversation now around gluten is that a lot of people, especially, and I've seen this in New York Times and different places, they still question whether or not gluten is an issue. And it seems like there's a black or white kind of understanding. A lot of people think that the gluten issue is kind of bullshit. It's all in your mind, if I can say it that way. And what's interesting about when you do the spectrum of intensity is that you have this whole range. And this middle place, all the way up to not having too much sensitivity, it sounds like in that area, that could be the place where people might just be having kind of usual bloating and issues and never really connecting it specifically to gluten.
Yeah, I mean it's a huge problem because, you know, the general medical community doesn't recognize it. Testing, I mean, I'm certainly, we're going to talk about that in the test that I use. But you know, new tests are just coming on the market about how to actually test for this. And then many symptoms. There's actually was a paper published called the Gluten Syndrome Neurological Diseases. And it actually showed that there were people who were having basically destruction of their nervous system and their brain, but absolutely no destruction from gluten, but no destruction in their gut from gluten. And so it's and there are studies showing that the number one place besides the gut that people have symptoms when they have a gluten sensitivity is neurologically. And so it's certainly something that people are not thinking about. And Dr. Perlmutter is actually coming out with a book, I think it's this summer, called Grain Brain. And it's all about, my understanding is it's going to be about, you know, Alzheimer's and I think he's going to have neurologic disorders in there, but certainly brain disorders like Alzheimer's, ADD, things like that, and how it really can be damaged by gluten. And I'm looking forward to that book. It's probably going to be awesome, talking about this.
Cool. Sounds really cool. So let's go into then symptoms. We're sort of leading into that now. So we have the sense of gluten. In your guide to living gluten-free, you write more than 55 diseases have been linked to gluten, the protein found in wheat, rye, and barley. It's estimated that 99% of the people who have either gluten intolerance or celiac disease are never diagnosed. It's also estimated that as many as 15% of the U.S. population is gluten intolerant. So, having that as a frame, I'm wondering what are some of the major symptoms you have seen, and what are ones that people can kind of look out for?
Yes, so that was funny. I was actually asked to write this article by the blog MindBodyGreen. And when they asked me to do it, I said, I can't do it. I mean, there's no way I can write an article about what are the signs and symptoms of gluten intolerance. It literally can be anything. I mean, I don't know how I could possibly write an article about that. And something literally just came to me, you know, just I was sitting at home and I said, okay, I'm going to do this. And so I did this 10 signs you're gluten intolerant. Now, I managed to put a lot of things on on each list. So I did kind of encompass anything. But back to what I was saying, I mean, it can be as I list here, I mean, it can be digestive issues, it can be brain fog and fatigue, it can be migraine headaches. For women, it can be hormonal imbalances, PCOS, infertility. It can be, you know, things often people, and I kind of got a lot of criticism for this, but I think that people misunderstood what I was trying to say, which is I do believe in chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia, and frequently gluten is a part of that. What I was saying when I write it, that it's, you know, if your doctor can't pinpoint your symptoms of chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia, then they should be looking at gluten because I typically see those go hand in hand. And of course, any kind of pain or swelling, particularly joint pain. When I hear somebody with joint pain, one of the first things I think about is gluten. And then the one that I wrote on there that really people, I think, got a lot of people thinking was that keratosis pilaris, which is at the back of your arm, what some people refer to as chicken skin. And I myself had that for many years. And that can be associated with fatty acid deficiency, which I believe is secondary to a gluten issue. And so there were a lot of people that wrote in about that, about the article, either that, oh my gosh, you know, I do have that. And then they got off gluten and felt better. Or people that wrote me and said, you know, I had had that before. And then I went gluten free. And, you know, I'm checking my arms now and I no longer have it. So that was really an eye-opener for a lot of people reading this article.
Well, that's one that struck me because I had that as well in the past. And I had that for probably about 2 years, maybe a year and a half. And I was off gluten most of the time. But I definitely, when I went to getting off gluten completely, I noticed a change there because I, at the same time, I'd also been supplementing with cod liver oil and certain things for vitamin A. And I found that it was helpful. But really, where it seemed like the rubber hit the road was when I just sort of said, okay, let's let this gluten thing go completely, not just every now and then. And now, I mean, I have none of that. And it's kind of amazing. If you've had that condition, because I have a lot of people who contact me about that one. They've tried all different things. And you've had that for a while, you know, it's just kind of annoying. And when you do get rid of it, it's such a great feeling.
It's so nice because I had it too, because your arms are kind of all bumpy. And I had it for so long. And it's like, I mean, I look at the back of my arms now and it's like, oh, there's nothing there. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty great. The other one that was interesting to me was mood disorders, anxiety, mood swings, ADD. What have you found in your practice with those?
Well, you know, gluten and dairy, casein, can have, they have a molecular structure that can mimic morphine for people. They're called gluteomorphins and caseomorphins. And so I see this typically with children. You know, some people can get off gluten and it's easy breezy for them. They have really no problem. They might miss it. Other people literally go through withdrawal reactions. And I have seen this time and time again in my practice. Children, or you know, even adults, when they're getting off the gluten and dairy, they feel terrible. They have mood swings. They have cravings. And so there really can be a physiologic addiction going on with the gluten itself. And then, of course, as we have talked about, and as we will talk about in the next podcast, all about the gut and how 95% of your neurotransmitters are made in your gut. And when gluten's getting there and causing a leaky gut, or is a byproduct of the leaky gut, all bets are off in terms of your emotions and moods and that being regulated and running like it should be.
Yeah, I think simply of just, you know, if I go to a movie and I have any kind of gastro distress, I'm in a bad mood and I can't even see the movie in front of me. And so I know there's a complex reaction with serotonin and all this, but also just the fact of if you feel gassy and bloated a lot of the time, I just feel like just simply you just often are not in a good mood because of that.
Yeah, well, they call your gut your second brain. Yep. So it's what is going on down there is definitely affecting mood and mind.
Okay, so you give us a bunch of the symptoms that we can look out for. You work with a lot of people who have tough issues, autoimmune issues. What are the symptoms or what are the conditions which you found it's essential to remove gluten?
Autoimmune, 100%. I mean, there is a direct correlation between gluten and autoimmune diseases. And if not all grains and legumes with the lectins that we've talked about before, and I'm sure we'll have a whole podcast just on autoimmune at some point, but that is a number one condition that I absolutely, you know, tell people not to go within 10 feet of gluten. The new research is coming out that every time you eat gluten, if you're one of us with an autoimmune disease, what I heard is that it stimulated your immune system for 3 months. I went to a lecture recently about sort of the gut gluten autoimmune connection, and it said it's 6 months. So that one little bite of a cupcake at the birthday party can stimulate your immune system, which is already stimulated because you've got an autoimmune disease, for 3 to 6 months. So if you're doing that twice a year, you're never really in the clear. So absolutely stay away from that if you have autoimmune. I tend to see kids, ADD and behavioral problems, autism, dyslexia, things like that is another absolute, you know, even if you heal the gut and are able to go back to eating it, those are situations where I would not go back to eating it. I mean, overall, you know, the research is really showing us that we have hybridized this. We have essentially genetically modified it, but it's called hybridization, where instead of changing the genes or replacing the genes combined. And it's a very, very inflammatory food. So, I mean, after reading the book Wheat Belly, I don't know why anybody'd even want to go near it, other than, yeah, it tastes good and it's easy and it's comfort food and all that stuff. But when you really look at the science behind, you know, inflammation being the root of all diseases, from cancer to autoimmune to infertility and mood-mind imbalances, really everything, it is an extremely, extremely inflammatory food.
All right. Well, you make a good case for it there, for sure.
I mean, as I tell my patients, you never, when you walk out of my office, you don't wonder how I feel about gluten. So as we'll have other guests on the show and people have varying opinions that you can go back to eating it. I had these two children, I think I talked about them on another podcast, these two little boys who were on the autism spectrum. They were twins, horrible eczema. I talk about it in the mycotoxin talk about how, you know, we helped their eczema, never fully went away until they treated their house for mold and then their guts healed and then their eczema went away. And the mom called me, she said, they can even eat gluten and dairy. I can't believe it. This is amazing. They had been living 2 years on rice and grass-fed beef. And my words to her were, even though they can eat those foods seemingly now, they're very, very inflammatory, and I wouldn't recommend eating them. We've altered our food, both with the cows and with the wheat, that it's not what I recommend.
Have you ever seen patients who come in and they follow your program for a while, they maybe have an autoimmune condition or something, and they get off gluten or some other symptom, they get off gluten for a while, they see a rebound where they feel really great, then they add it back in and they sort of spiral down again and come back and see you?
I do on occasion. Certainly, I'm not going to tell you that every single patient does exactly what I say and lives the life that I live. But as we've talked about on many occasions, many, many, many of them do. I really do love all my patients, and I love that they listen to me. I think it's several fold of why I have such high compliance. One, I am leading by example. I mean, it's clear how I feel about it, and I don't slip up. I don't eat gluten. So that's one. Two, you know, people have self-selected to come see me. Many are traveling across the country. They're paying out of pocket, you know, and three, they feel better. They're off their medicines. They got better. And four, I educate them just like we are in this podcast about really what is it doing to your body. And when you have that knowledge, then people typically, you know, make choices, you know, an informed choice. And when you hear things like, wow, if you even have that bite of a cupcake, it stimulated your immune system for 6 months. Once you hear that, if you've been in a boat that's of multiple autoimmune diseases and you've been on, you know, horrible medicines that made things worse and you were able to get off of these, you know, hearing a statement like that is usually enough to keep somebody off of it. Not to mention most people, I mean, they feel so much better that it's really not even tempting to them.
When you said before, Amy, about stimulating the immune system, is that what you mean by, is that inflammation? If it's stimulated for 6 months, what does that mean? What is, give a little clearer picture of what that means for people.
Sure. So one of the things that is easy to track for patients and I see a lot of is autoimmune thyroid. And so we can track, as they get off gluten, we can track their antibodies coming down. And I have heard one time at a talk, well, then if you accidentally get gluten or you choose to eat it, your antibodies to your thyroid would go up. And that sounds plausible to me. But I actually had several of my patients who that happened to, and we did check their antibodies, or somebody who actually wanted to go eat it and try it themselves, or somebody whose antibodies were not coming down. I had this one patient, they weren't coming down, and she wasn't doing gluten-free. I finally convinced her she did gluten-free. They went down. Then she fell off the wagon, and we tracked them. They came back up. So I see this. You can't, for most people, you can't feel when these antibodies are high or low or what they're doing in your body. It's silent inflammation. Now, if you're quote-unquote lucky and you have, you know, a rheumatologic disorder or an inflammatory bowel disorder, you might be able to feel that inflammation, right? You would feel it in your joints or you'd feel it in your gut when you ate this. And so that might deter you. Those with autoimmune thyroid, they don't really feel anything when their antibodies go up. Most people don't report, oh, I can feel, unless it's really bad or an acute situation. Most people don't say, oh, I feel my thyroid swelling up. So we can track their antibodies, and I have found a correlation. I mean, of course, it's a small percentage of people that I've done this with, but I have definitely seen, and I definitely have labs where people have either accidentally gotten gluten or they wanted to experiment and see if their antibodies would go up. And I, of course, was happy to oblige because it's interesting information to me to be able to say, yes, I actually do have documented cases where this is exactly what has happened. So that's what I mean by stimulating your immune system.
So clearly you're using testing there. If someone wants to know where they fall on this spectrum of intensity, what's the process you recommend them to go through?
So number one is really the gold standard is to take it out of your diet and to add it back in. So you can simply do that on your own. You can eliminate gluten from your diet for 3 weeks, 30 days, and add it back in and see how you feel. If you need something more supervised, we have, you know, the Myers Way program, and we'll have you remove gluten as well as a whole host of other foods. You don't necessarily have to do all the other foods if you're just curious about gluten, and we sort of walk you through that process. And that's the gold standard, is really to see how your body reacts. And I say if you feel better off of it or you feel worse on it, those are clues. Of course, there's blood testing that we can do. You mean you can test for celiac, and the test for celiac is you can do some genetic testing to see, you know, if you have the HLA, DQ2 and DQ8. for celiac disease if you possess the genes. There's also trans tissue glutaminase and anti-endosomal light antibodies and that you can check for celiac. A lot of people don't have celiac, but they do fall into the gluten sensitivity spectrum. Of course, also with celiac, you can get a biopsy. You know, none of these tests are perfect. And so again, if you feel better off it or worse on it, that's the gold standard. In terms of checking for gluten sensitivity in my clinic, I use, of course, what we've just discussed in terms of getting off of it. And then there's also some gluten antibody IgG and IgA testing that we can do, which is a blood test. Those are pretty good. I find a lot of people in my clinic come back positive for those. And certainly the gluten antibody IgA is, if that's high, that can be one of the first markers to go up for celiac. So it can sort of be a pre-celiac marker or even a celiac marker. The problem with that is that it's only checking for one of the gliadins, gliadin 33, I believe it is. And so there are other gliadins, and you could be reacting to some of the others and not that one. But that is what most people are using, is this standard, you know, gluten antibody test. I have started using more testing through a lab, Cyrex. I've mentioned it on a lot of different podcasts, and they do a much more comprehensive test looking for all of the different gliadins. And I am starting to use that a little bit more with people. Like, I had a patient yesterday or last week who didn't have autoimmune, and I mean, certainly had some issues, but she wasn't super sick. And, you know, I didn't have any good reason to keep her off gluten if her test didn't show up positive. So I wanted to give us every chance possible to really know if she was reacting to gluten or not. When I have people coming in with autoimmune, as I said at the beginning of the podcast, I automatically believe you have a gluten issue based on my knowledge of gluten and autoimmune diseases and the correlation between them, that no matter what a test showed back for gluten, I would strongly advise you to be off of it. So if she had had autoimmune, I wouldn't have bothered to do the other tests because I would be, you know, recommending that she get off of it regardless. But sometimes patients want to see the test. I mean, I had a situation with a family, they're divorced, and the mom had seizures. So that's another one. I don't think I put that on my 10 signs you're gluten intolerant list, but seizures can be gluten. And she had horrible, horrible seizures. Finally, after many, many years of doctor after doctor, realized it was gluten. She got off gluten. Her two kids had behavioral problems. She got them off gluten. They were beginning to improve. She was divorced. So the kids were half with her and half with her ex-husband. And in the beginning, the ex-husband was on board and got them off gluten, but then he wanted them tested. And they went to a conventional doctor and did celiac testing. And of course, they came up negative for that. So she was bringing them to me, and then we did the Cyrex test. We haven't gotten the results back yet, but we did the Cyrex testing because we didn't want there to be sort of any stone unturned, since it was the husband was, I think he's an engineer and very science-oriented and needed to see a positive test. He said he wouldn't do it unless he saw a positive test.
I understand that about the testing. I definitely know that personally I like seeing the tests as well. It keeps my resolve more, especially if I have to go off certain types of foods like gluten. So I definitely see. So thank you for sharing all the different kinds of testing. And it's as I was listening to you, I was thinking, wow, it can feel complicated. So Dr. Myers has put together the Myers Way Guide to Gluten-Free Living to help people and help you kind of go through that and figure out what you need. And then you can also, if you're in the Austin area, also see Dr. Myers. Is that right?
Yeah, you can actually, I mean, last week, I think almost every one of my patients had flown in from somewhere else. So we're happy to see you no matter where you are. You just have to fly in once, and then we can do everything by phone from there.
Two questions that people have asked me recently about gluten and reintroducing gluten to try to figure out how strongly they're affected by it. So one of these questions was, if you do remove gluten for 3 weeks, and then when you reintroduce it, you start to feel all these issues, you start to feel gas and bloating and things like that. Does that have anything to do with just the bacteria in the gut changing for a new food? Because if it, there's a lot of different things like that, especially for people who have been on restrictive diets for at certain periods of time, they add a food back in and they start feeling those issues. So the question was, when you reintroduce it and you feel that first period, do you need to go a little bit further with it, or what's your thoughts on that?
So when I hear somebody adding a food back in and gas and bloating, I think a couple of things. One, I think a genuine food sensitivity. The other thing that I think is a feeding of an infection. So if you perhaps, when you remove the gluten, if maybe you were eating a lower carb diet and then you were suddenly going back to this higher carb, it could be that you had diminished whatever infection was in your gut and now you're feeding it. And then there is certainly the possibility that the gut is just leaky and that you're responding to the food because your gut is leaky rather than you actually have an issue with the food. So, I mean, even in myself saying that, you know, it doesn't seem complicated in my clinic, but I can see how to somebody out there, you know, their head might just be swarming and feeling overwhelmed and confused at this. But, you know, we really can take a very slow, stepwise approach to sort out what it is. And that is the advantage, of course, of being able to be seen by a functional medicine practitioner and, you know, and getting some testing to help guide us so we know what's going on rather than sort of guessing, because adding something in and bloating could mean any one of those things that I mentioned.
So there's not a case where when you add a new food in, there's actually just a change that needs to happen. Most foods, if it works for your body, when you add it back in, there should be really no issues.
Well, in an optimal world, but as we have discussed about the gut and the bacteria in the gut, I mean, these bacteria are helping us digest these foods, and food influences our gut bacteria. So yes, I would say that it certainly could be plausible that certain bacteria get what we would say down-regulated, and enzymes get down-regulated if you're really not eating that food. But I mean, again, since we've hybridized wheat and we don't really know how to digest that anyway, I don't know how that would fit into the picture. But if you just took something like rice and quinoa, you know, the enzymes and bacteria needed to break down those foods are the same. So if you took rice out of your diet and added it back in a month later, I would think that that would be a seemingly easy process, that wouldn't be, that nothing would have gotten down-regulated in that amount of time. I mean, wheat, it's hard to say because we've hybridized it, and so there may be certain more bacteria or enzymes that have come around to help you digest that, and when you get rid of the wheat, it's unlike the rice or the quinoa or whatever other grain or carb that you might have been eating. The bottom line is, I don't know that anybody knows the answer to that question. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of, you know, thinking through it as you and I are having this conversation.
Yeah, it's a good question. It was one that was asked to me
recently. Yeah, I mean, it's a great question.
Okay, so Amy, this is one of your specialties here, especially in talking about gluten, of going deeper into the gluten question. And let's say the example is that I've removed gluten from my diet, but I'm still experiencing symptoms. So maybe I've just had some dairy, or I've had coffee, or even chocolate. What's going on here?
So we now realize that there are a host of foods that can mimic gluten in the body. It's called cross-reactivity or molecular mimicry. And that is that the proteins in these foods, like corn and eggs and dairy, they look so much like gluten that when our immune system's coming around looking for invaders and we are viewing gluten as foreign, it might accidentally pick up the casein or the rice as being foreign as well, because the protein looked the same or very similar. So that is certainly one place when people are seeing me and they've gone gluten-free and they're still having problems. There is, again, you can either remove that specific list of foods, and it's listed in my ebook under, you know, gluten and cross-reactivity. You could either remove those foods like you would in an elimination diet. Most of them are removed I believe, on my general Myers Way elimination diet anyway. So you could remove those foods and gradually add them back in and see how you respond. Or, of course, there is testing as well towards those. And just of note, I don't think it's been changed in our book quite yet, but when it says coffee, the company has stated that that actually is instant coffee now, and it's probably from some cross-contamination of instant coffee rather than coffee. So for all those coffee drinkers out there, you can continue on with your coffee.
Wait, that's interesting, because I've definitely read some articles, and I think we've talked about the doctor who put a lot out there about cholesterol activity with coffee, but now that's been changed a little bit. So not coffee in general, but instant coffee.
It's instant coffee. At least that is what they're testing for in this test. And the new test actually says instant coffee on it.
That is very, very interesting. Well, I'm sure that will make a lot of people very, very happy, out there.
Yes, absolutely. Although the funny thing is, you know, whether it's placebo or not, but because of that, and because I wrote that and other people have seen that, you know, it's kind of gone viral on the internet, a lot of people have given up coffee. And I definitely have had people telling me, you know, I was better. Now, I don't know if that's the acidity of coffee, or, you know, if that's some sort of cross-contamination and processing and transport, or, you know, something else in coffee. But I have had people, I mean, it is an acidic, you know, it is an acidic food or drink, and, you know, some people don't do well with it. I mean, I think that's also part of, you know, what is happening, you know, with people having their morning coffee and then a bowel movement. I mean, so anyway, I've had people tell me that they got better off of coffee, what the mechanism is, placebo, acidity, some cross-reactivity with gluten. Mm. I don't know.
Wait, so, and what were you saying there about the bowel movement in the morning with coffee?
Well, I know for me, I rarely ever drink coffee, but even if I have decaf or regular coffee, I tend to have, you know, either more frequent bowel movements or a looser bowel movement, or I drink a cup of coffee and I go have a bowel movement. So, you know, I don't think I do well with coffee. So I don't know if that's sort of if it's its way of sort of stimulating my system or aggravating my system, maybe I should say.
and so you would say that's actually, rather than a good thing, because a lot of people aren't moving their bowels enough, that's actually something that could be a sign that it's not really working.
It could be, yes.
Interesting. Very, very interesting. So is there any rule of thumb for how long someone would remove these foods if they feel like they might have some cross-reactivity happening, let's say corn? Or I think in the Myers way, you've removed most of these, but for someone who's maybe just removing gluten and is noticing that, wow, oats, which definitely is something I've seen very common, oats having that similar effect. Any amount of time that might be useful people to remember?
Yeah, so I first want to address the oats, which is, so there are certified gluten-free oats out there. And just to note that you can have 20 parts per billion of gluten in a certified gluten-free product. And so there is, you know, depending on how frequently you're eating this, you could still be getting exposed to gluten. The other part about oatmeal or oats, even the certified gluten ones, it goes back to that cross-reactivity or molecular mimicry. The proteins in oats, I find, are the most similar to any of the other foods, to gluten, than any of the other foods on that list. And I have time and time again had people who were gluten-free, even, you know, doing well with me, haven't seen them in a year, and they, you know, innocently added gluten-free oats in, certified gluten-free oats, thinking all was well, and then come back with problems, and we get them off the oats, the certified gluten-free oats. So particularly with autoimmune, certified gluten-free oats, in my opinion, are a big no-no. So just you know, word of caution out there, of all these foods, even the certified gluten-free oats are the thing, you know, the biggest problem for a lot of people. So to your question, how long to remove foods? Well, you know, removing the food is certainly one part of the process of healing, but fixing the gut is the major part of healing someone. So I often find people who, you know, have, before they've come to see me, they've seen someone else, they've gotten these food sensitivity tests, they've been off the foods for quite some time, and they're trying to add them back in, and they still really can't. And I find that it's because nobody ever looked at the gut and healed the gut. But if you're someone who's being followed by a functional medicine practitioner, or certainly seeing me, and we're healing your gut at the same time that we're eliminating these foods, we typically tell people 3 to 6 months that you can then try to add the food back in. And then you have to figure out, you know, is it a true food sensitivity, i.e., you just no way around it, you're not going to be able to eat it, versus a food sensitivity as a result of having a leaky gut. It's just been slipping through your gut into your bloodstream and causing, you know, an immune reaction. And so if that's the case, that should be 3 to 6 months. You stay off the food, you heal the gut, then you ought to be able to go back to it.
And for you, we talked about this on our second podcast about the Myers way, but other things that you add in for healing the gut. So not just removing the foods is important, but there's also other elements as well, right? So you're adding in certain supplements, certain other things that you're adding in to help the gut heal.
Yes. So there are certainly, I believe we did talk about it in the second podcast, and we'll talk about it in the next one as well, the 4R approach to healing the gut, you know, removing the foods, removing the infections, re-inoculating the gut with good probiotics, restoring what is missing, enzymes, things like that, and then repairing with L-glutamine. So there's also an article on my blog, which is just dramymyers.com, and I have several articles about healing the gut, one about the 4R program specifically, and then one about, you know, 8 different supplements that can be used to heal the gut.
Cool. And for those people who want to hear again about the Myers way, you can find that on our second podcast.
Yes. And they can also download the ebook off of my website. You can either go to Dr. Amy Myers and it will take you to my store, which actually is housed on my clinic website, which is austinultrahealth.com.
Okay, so we talked about cross-reactivity in foods. Now let's talk about some of the other areas, the sort of hidden sources of gluten that might still be affecting people. In your guide, you talk about hidden sources of gluten, and this is something that you really emphasize. So some of the examples you cite are shampoos, medications, Play-Doh, even stamps. Can these items really cause a reaction?
Well, certainly, you know, it's so funny, you know, how one's mindset changes over time. When I got into this, I thought, there's no way that, you know, beauty products, that this could be a problem. I mean, your skin pores, there's no way gluten's too big, it can't get through. Then as I've gone through this process, both personally and, oh, that's my dog, Bella. Hi, B, what you doing? We can't bark. We're not barking, okay? Okay, so certainly as I've gone through this process, both personally and professionally, I have certainly seen that, yes, in fact, people do react to the glutens in, some people react to glutens in beauty products. I mean, the theory is that you shower and then your pores open up and you lather up with shampoo conditioner and body wash, and then afterwards your pores are open and you go put on your lotion. So it's very common to have glutens in a lot of these. And, you know, we have some certified, or I mean, they don't even contain gluten at all, but gluten-free body products, you know, on our website, because people are constantly asking me. I use Dr. Bronner's soap for, you know, pretty much everything. It's free and clear of everything. And, you know, I know that even when I travel, I take my own shampoo and lotion and conditioners and all that stuff. When I go get my haircut, I do just let her use whatever shampoo. But I itch afterwards. I mean, it definitely bothers me. And I have other people who tell me they'll break out in a rash if they wash with gluten shampoo. I mean, not gluten shampoo, but shampoo that, you know, has some wheat protein in it. So these are real. It's used in a lot of fillers and medications. So, I mean, you could not be getting better on a gluten-free diet because you take, you know, 4 medications a day and they all have a binder with some gluten in it. And so, you know, in the ebook, there's a link that you can click on, and I've forgotten the website offhand, but it, you know, will tell you if your medication contains wheat or gluten in it. So, yes, I mean, there are all kinds of moms on the website talking about their kids. You know, I don't know so much about the Play-Doh with it, just them playing with the Play-Doh, but kids are kids, and if they're playing with Play-Doh, they're probably young enough that they're putting their fingers in their mouths and, you know, eating some of the Play-Doh themselves. And so that's probably more where the problem's coming from rather than just, you know, through the skin. But You know, who knows? And then another source that people really don't think about is candy. You know, even, I mean, licorice, it's made from wheat protein. So one, you know, source that people just don't think about because they're thinking, oh, how could this jelly bean possibly have gluten in it? I mean, it's just going to be sugar, right? Sugar and some coloring. No, I mean, they, a lot of times, again, gluten, glue, it's what keeps these things, you know, sticking together.
The other two that I found really interesting in there were when you're at restaurants, scrambled eggs, which use pancake batter to make their eggs fluffier or some kind of packaged wheat product, and then mashed potatoes. That's one that I always forget about, that there's often, or probably most of the time, there's flour added to thicken them.
Yeah, yeah. And then the one, well, this is hidden sources of gluten. We do another one on cross-contamination, but one, I'll mention it here, that people really don't think about frequently as well, as they go to the Mexican restaurant and they're making their own corn tortilla chips at the restaurant, or they go somewhere and they get some French fries. And inherently, you know, potatoes and corn should be gluten-free. But once they get them in the fryer with the other things, you know, they could be doing a, you know, some sort of hush puppies or something like that that they fry, or fried shrimp that they're frying in the same batter as the French fries. And then suddenly there's all this gluten all over your French fries as well. So you really got to ask these questions. And that's what my ebook was intended to do, because you know, what happens with a lot of people who are trying to navigate this themselves, you know, they've gotten diagnosed by their, either the primary care doctor or their gastroenterologist, particularly if they're a celiac. Now, I mean, a lot of the national celiac websites have some pretty good resources, but people go gluten-free immediately and they might feel better because they got all that gluten out of their system, and then they start not feeling well again. And it's because they're getting, you know, this cross-contamination, or eating things that they don't think has gluten in it, and it really does. And so that was the intent of this ebook, was really, you know, after you've gotten over that initial hump, or if you're, you know, confused in the first place or whatnot, that here's some additional resources for you.
So Amy, when I'm really interested in that thing that you just brought up about fries and corn tortillas and things like that. Do you ever have those things and ask directly, and do you think it's, you can trust the people? It's just such an interesting question.
Yeah, so I don't eat corn or potatoes anymore, but I was up until several months ago, or at least the potatoes somewhat, and corn, I mean, it's been a while. But yes, I mean, I know in my city where I can go and who, you know, I specifically say, do you make your own corn tortillas? You do? What does it have, its own fryer, or do you fry anything else in it? Most people, are there enough people gluten-free now asking those questions? Typically, they might know. I mean, not if you're going to, I mean, here in Austin, we have the East Side, and it's a lot of Mexican restaurants, you know, really authentic, and they may have no idea what you're talking about. Or if you go to an Asian restaurant and they're really authentic restaurants where people aren't even barely speaking English, they may not be able to answer that. But, you know, a typical restaurant, if they don't know, they can go back and ask the chef. I mean, it's pretty clear. There's one or two fryers. So, you know, that oil is expensive and they're frying typically most everything in it. So there are definitely some restaurants here in Austin that have separate fryers. There's a place, I don't know if y'all have any in California, but it's called Elevation Burger. And it's a fast food place, but they use all grass-fed, organic grass-fed beef. And their French fries are fried in olive oil, and they have a fryer all themselves. It's the only thing that they fry.
Wow.
And you know, the owner happened to be there one day that I was there, and I asked him, you know, all these questions specifically, like, is your grass-fed beef grass-fed the entire way? It's not just grass-finished. And you know, he was able to answer these questions. So it really depends on where you go. But the more you know in order to be able to ask the right question, because if you just say, are your chips gluten-free, they're going to say yes, because inherently a tortilla chip should not have gluten in it. I've even asked, again, I don't eat corn anymore, but when I was, I would even ask, oh, you know, no, you buy them? Could I see one of the bags? You know? And because there's a local corn, they're two local, you know, we're here in Texas, so they're two local manufacturers of corn chips, and they actually are, you know, they say gluten-free, certified gluten-free on their bags. So I knew the brands when I was eating corn to know which ones to ask for.
All right. Well, great, great tips there. Okay, Amy, well, we're getting to the end here. Give us some great information. For those people now who You know, wait for this
plane.
Okay. So Amy, those were some great tips. I'm definitely going to start asking more when I'm out at restaurants. For those people now who are looking to maybe go more gluten-free or are gluten-free and might be a little bit overwhelmed by what they might consider the sort of enormity of this task, do you have any tips for doing this? I know you state a couple of them inside your ebook.
Yeah, so I mean, I would say get the ebook. It's only $4.99. In fact, if you join my newsletter, you get an ebook that has 12 of my favorite gluten-free, dairy-free recipes, but we're also going to have a coupon for 50% off the ebook in the newsletter when this podcast gets announced next Tuesday. So highly recommend that you just sign up for my newsletter, and you can do that at dramymyers.com or austinultrahealth.com. And there is a lot more information that we didn't talk about in there. It will kind of walk you through some tips of how to do this. Don't get overwhelmed. I was being interviewed for another podcast yesterday and just saying that it's a journey, and it literally is one step at a time. You might slip backwards. Some people can make a big leap. Other people need to go one day at a time. And so don't beat yourself up. Get educated, which is what we're trying to help you do. If you need some extra assistance, I have a nutritionist on staff, and she does do wellness coaching. So you can set up an on-the-phone appointment with her, or even come in and see her if you'd like. And she can help you with this, help come up with some more recipes, and really, we're just here to support you. And, you know, my blog, I'm constantly writing about this stuff, and Facebook page, and you can, you know, just reach out to other like-minded people, and don't give up, and just go one day at a time.
All right, Amy. Well, thank you so much for everything we need to know about gluten today.
Thanks, John.
To stay in touch with Dr. Myers, you can sign up for her newsletter on her website at dramymyers.com or connect with her on Facebook or Twitter at amymyersmd.